Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, the Michelin-starred restaurants of Greater Los Angeles with Elena Shatkin joining us from LAist.com. And in the second hour, we'll have the release of the homeless population figures for Southern California. Matt Tinoco, KPCC reporter, will be with us for that. But first, we begin by comparing and contrasting the Democratic presidential candidates' climate change plans of fossil fuel control measures, whether they're cap and trade systems or whether they see a carbon tax as the vehicle or other forms of government regulation. With us to talk about the proposals that are out there from Axios, based in D.C., is Amy Harder, energy and climate change reporter for Axios. She also writes the weekly column Harder Line, focusing on climate change. Amy, good to have you with us. So we have Joe Biden with his plan that came out today. Earlier, there was, I think it was in the New York Times, a report from someone close to the Biden campaign saying his would be a more moderate approach. What you've been able to learn so far, how would you categorize what Biden's proposing?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was a report in Reuters that quoted a campaign aide saying that Biden's plan would be, quote, a middle ground on climate change, and that really created a firestorm of criticism across the liberal spectrum from everybody from Senator Bernie Sanders, another presidential candidate, of course, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, all criticized him, saying there's no such thing as a middle ground on climate change, given the urgency of the problem. So then fast forward to today with the release of the vice president, the former vice president's plan, and any sort of semblance of, quote, middle ground is gone from the proposal we see today. And he echoes a lot of the same rhetoric that we're seeing from others on the campaign trail and echoes of the Green New Deal, which has really taken Washington and, in particular, the Democratic Party by storm over the last 6 months.
Was there speculation that Biden would try and sidestep the Green New Deal as opposed to going after it as unrealistic and then come out with something more moderate? And in contrast to that, does his proposal say anything about the Green New Deal?
His campaign says that he supports the aspirations of the Green New Deal, but he doesn't come out in black and white to say that he explicitly supports what's in it. And you're seeing that, in fact, across the spectrum from some of the candidates, of course, not all, and there's, you know, more than two dozen, so it's hard to sort of group them, generally speaking. But there's components of the Green New Deal that you're not seeing in hardly any of the Democratic presidential candidates' proposals. And those are the ones that are beyond energy and climate change, namely the federal jobs guarantee and universal health care and federal housing. Those are broader social programs that aren't directly connected to energy and climate change. And you're not seeing those in a lot of these proposals.
Joe Biden's plan, $1.7 trillion over 10 years to combat climate change, and it calls for cutting net emissions of greenhouse gases to zero by 2050. And what I've seen of the coverage, Amy, is that he proposes funding that by repealing the tax cuts that were passed by the previous Republican Congress. What's the funding gap, though, between what reinstating the higher taxes would be and what it would cost to reach net zero emissions by 2050?
Well, that's one of the many questions that I think some of the energy and more policy-oriented people will be having over the next year as we really kick into high gear with the campaign. I think this concern about how to pay for these really big policies is one of the biggest issues with all of these campaigns. I think it's easy to say that, you know, we have these goals. It's going to be very difficult to pay for it, and I think that's one of the biggest questions. I think in this case, whether or not the tax cuts being repealed, going toward that money, it depends on going toward the policy of net zero emissions by 2050. I think it depends on how exactly that's achieved. And I think, you know, almost all of these policies rely on Congress. And so, you know, we've seen what a Democratic president can do with climate change without congressional support, and that was President Obama's 8 years in the White House. So we're seeing a lot of these big aspirations, but it'll really depend on if both chambers are controlled by Democrats after the election. Then that will really be able to give the Democratic president, if there is one, a chance to act upon these goals.
We're talking with Axios's Amy Harder, energy and climate change reporter for the news site. Amy, which candidates have embraced a carbon tax, which, you know, would be a very heavy lift politically, of course, because of the effect on consumers? And which of them have embraced cap and trade as a way of getting to net zero emissions?
This is definitely a question that reporters, that people like me, love to ask. It's one that a lot of candidates are actually skirting for the moment, in part because, you know, carbon tax is a very politically charged term that doesn't have a ton of support across the spectrum. There are a few, however, that do support it. Pete Buttigieg has supported it. Senator Cory Booker has said he would support it. The Biden campaign confirmed to Axios that the legislation that Biden would call upon Congress to pass would include some sort of price mechanism, which is sort of a euphemism for carbon tax of some type or carbon price. And I think you're going to see a lot of this sort of dancing around some of the rhetoric in terms of how to actually reduce emissions, because there's not a lot of ways to do it. There's a carbon price, there's cap and trade, as you mentioned, and then the other one is basically by mandate. And that would be considered the least cost-effective from those being targeted, but they could be the most popular from a political perspective. So I think those types of details will be ones that candidates try to avoid for as long as they can, because they're just so politically tough.
And, Amy, do any of the candidates get into the specifics of cars? Because, of course, here in Southern California, where we see record numbers of, you know, car ownership and cars on the road, and even though all electric and hybrid vehicles do have a bigger market share, it's still, you know, tiny compared to the internal combustion cars. Have any of them got into the specifics of how they would deal with all of the gas-fueled cars on the road?
Biden's campaign includes, quote, rigorous new vehicle economy standards that would, according to the campaign, ultimately ensure 100% of light and medium sales are electric vehicles. But the campaign did not include a date on that. So, you know, saying that that's possible even by 2050 is very unlikely. But they do say sales as opposed to cars on the road. And, you know, the F-150 has been the most popular car, you know, vehicle sold in America for decades. And so to what extent trucks can become electric, I think, is a really big open question. And so I think for now you're really seeing the candidates focus on the electricity sector, because it is so much easier to make it cleaner. And the transportation sector will be a lot trickier. We've already seen that under Obama, and I anticipate that we'll see it again as sort of the second round of actions that any Democratic president would take, because it's so difficult.
Amy, I would anticipate this is going to be a significant part of the candidate debates coming up. And do you think it likely that we're going to see the candidates really pushing each other on this? Or is that fraught because once you get into the specifics and what the costs are, what consumers might have to pay, that's just politically dangerous territory to get into those specifics?
I think to answer that question, you want to divide it up, you know, primary and general. And so I think in the primary campaign, you will see a lot of criticism among the very crowded field to see who can have the most aggressive policies. You know, Democratic-based voters really do care about this issue. That's what the polling shows. And let's recall that occurred also in the last election. Hillary Clinton running against Bernie Sanders, she tacked quite far to the left during the primary, and then she kind of moved back to the center in the general. So what I'll be looking for is to what degree you see sort of a race to the left during the primary season, and then to what degree the nominee has to shift a little bit more to the center to appeal to those voters who, although they acknowledge climate change and think it's a problem, are also concerned about the cost it'll impose on them.
Amy Harder, thanks so much. Good to talk with you today. From the news site Axios, she writes the weekly Harder Line column focused on climate change. She's energy and climate change reporter for Axios. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation and hear a conservative perspective from Nick Loris at the Heritage Foundation. It's Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, Alina Shatkin of LA is with us to talk about the Michelin stars that have just come out for Southern California restaurants. These are perhaps the most coveted of all restaurant ratings. If not here in Southern California, then certainly internationally. We'll talk about that momentarily. But first, more discussion on the Democratic candidates' climate proposals. Both Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden coming out with theirs. They join virtually every other candidate with some degree of proposal that's out there. With a conservative perspective from the Heritage Foundation, energy economist Nick Loris joining us from D.C. Nick, thank you for being with us again. We appreciate it. Your thoughts about sort of how these lay out the trade-offs that are entailed?
Yeah, to me, the biggest trade-offs are the high cost of the plan from a taxpayer expense. I mean, if you're talking about the federal government footing the bill for a lot of these clean energy spending activities, $170 billion a year or more, that's going to come from the taxpayers. And so that's going to not just harm current generations, but future generations as well. And the second big concern from my perspective is the higher energy costs and the negative ripple effects that will have throughout the economy. The reason that 80% of our energy needs come from conventional fuels that emit CO2 is that they're abundant and affordable. And if there's a transition away from those fuels that are forced by the federal government, that's going to exact significant costs on the American people. In fact, it was President Obama who said under his cap and trade plan that electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket to drive up energy costs that would reduce the use of electricity.
Fuel conservation, yeah. Nick, I wonder, though, about the costs that are embedded with fossil fuels, because, of course, there are costs that come from that. The projections for what, you know, warming of the climate is going to mean in mitigations for sea level rise and other things. So how do you factor what the immediate costs of implementing one of these plants might be versus the costs down the road for the climate change impact?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my other concern with these plans is that even if they're enacted, I don't think it changes the future of the climate around the planet. If you look at climate models in terms of reducing U.S. emissions down to zero, it would only abate warming a few tenths of a degree Celsius by the year 2100. So even if we enacted these plans, I think we'd be in the same position where we are when it comes to a warming planet and sea level rise and some of the cost impacts that we could see from future warming. So I think we should take more cost-effective, pragmatic steps, activities like adaptation that have proven to be very cost effective and also very good in terms of preventative the damages that we can see from a changing climate, no matter what the cause is. I certainly think that fossil fuels should be responsible for the environmental consequences of their use and the externalities that they produce on societies, but to tease out fossil fuels and blame them for the changing climate is difficult to do when we don't know all the factors for what's driving the climate. Certainly, activity and man-made emissions are playing a role, but they're not 100% to blame for a changing climate either.
So what I'm hearing you say is that we're still going to end up paying in the future because the climate's going to change anyway, and our ability in this country to limit it is not all that great. But wouldn't the U.S. – I mean, the idea is that if the U.S. – undertakes such extensive measures, that puts the pressure on the rest of the world to do similarly.
I'm not sure I think that the rest of the world will follow suit because right now their priority is accessing affordable, reliable energy, and they've shown a willingness to commit to building and providing their citizens with conventional sources of energy, coal, oil, and natural gas well into the future, no matter what the United States does. I do think that there are productive actions that policymakers and the federal government can take to drive innovation for carbon-free and emissions-free energy resources and to drive more energy innovation at our national labs, as well as look at some of the direct air capture technologies that can help mitigate CO2 emissions as well. But what we do here in the United States doesn't look like it's going to have much impact on what the rest of the world is going to do, especially developing countries like India and China, who are going to be responsible for a large share of current and future emissions.
Heritage Foundation energy economist Nick Loras joining us from D.C. Let me go back to Axios energy and climate change reporter Amy Harder. Amy, for the Democratic candidates, how would they likely respond to that idea that even if the U.S. went to net zero fossil fuel emissions, the impact would be minimal globally?
That's a pretty common argument from Republicans and industry officials and others who are not supportive of aggressive action on climate change. And from a purely technical perspective, it's entirely accurate that if the U.S. acted in isolation, it would not have an impact on the global temperature. And that's why this issue is so hard. It doesn't mean necessarily don't act because of that. It just gets at the issue that climate change has this collective action problem, that if all of us act in isolation, it wouldn't have an impact. I think it goes to this this point that America's leadership has a lot of influence on the global stage. And we saw that under President Obama. The U.S. put on a plan to reduce its emissions, and then it got China and India on board, in particular China. Now, China's commitment to the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement is pretty controversial because it actually allows them to continue emitting and increasing their emissions to at least 2030. But nonetheless, they were at the table, and actually China is leading the world on renewable energy, also a lot of other more polluting technologies. But they're positioned to be leaders on these technologies. And so they see it, China sees it as a geopolitical way to one-up America. And I think that's something that you saw, for example, in Biden's climate plan today. He talked about trying to beat China.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Amy, for joining us. Nick, thank you for being with us as well. Amy Harder of Axios, where she writes the Harderline Climate Change Weekly column, as well as a reporter on energy and climate change. And Nick Loras, energy economist for the Heritage Foundation. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Coming up next hour, we're going to be talking about the new homeless census numbers for Southern California. So we're going to get into that news. But first, on a much lighter note, Michelin has come out with its starred reviews for Southern California restaurants. Elena Shatkin, who is the food editor for LAist, joins me. Good morning, Elena.
Hi, good morning.
This is very exciting that finally LA is back on the Michelin map, so to speak. Although when you joined us last time, there was some pushback, like, who needs Michelin?
But I mean, I'll be honest, Larry, I was pretty skeptical about the whole Michelin guide because, in part, I'm just generally skeptical about outsiders, people who aren't from here, trying to, you know, make wild, often stupid claims about the culture of food and, you know, just life here in Los
Angeles.
Let
us who are natives make the stupid, wild claims.
Or at least those of us who have lived here most of their adult lives. That counts as a native, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But also in specific, the Michelin has a pretty sad, bad, tortured history here in Los Angeles. Like, when it was here, I mean, it slunk out of town in, about a decade ago.
Under cloak of darkness.
Yeah, it slunk out of Los Angeles with its tail tucked between its skinny French legs the last time it was here because, you know, So it published a Michelin guide, I want to say like 2008, 2009, 2010, right? And their restaurants were basically like what, you know, a not particularly creative, you know, businessman in Beverly Hills might go to on his like an Italian restaurant he might go to on his expense account for lunch. Right. That was kind of the bulk of their restaurants. And they were savaged, and rightfully so, by people who lived here and who knew food and were like, this isn't our city. This doesn't reflect us.
So, Elaine, as you look at the starred selections for the 2019 rankings, and we'll get to the specifics, do you feel like this is a more sophisticated look at the L.A. restaurant scene?
It's definitely a much improved look at the L.A. restaurant scene than it was a decade ago. I mean, there's definitely a lot of things the Michelin Guide could and should do better. But like I said, I was so much more skeptical that it was going to be so much worse. Maybe just that my expectations were low. But I do see a lot of interesting restaurants that they've chosen. I'm glad to see that they've, you know, in between all their different, you know, their one star, their two star, their Bib Gourmand, and just the other restaurants that are in the guide, which I am.
You got your hands on the copy
I'm
of
flipping,
it.
I'm flipping through it right here. You know,
it's got new book smell, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I'm seeing, you know, great, interesting things like I'm seeing Wes Avila's Gorilla Tacos, which is fantastic. I'm seeing Middle Eastern restaurants. I'm seeing a handful of Korean restaurants. They could really do better with covering Koreatown. Cough, cough. But I'm seeing just a better selection that's more interesting.
That's great. Well, I'd love to hear from listeners if you've had a chance to look at the restaurants starred or even the ones that are recommended that don't have the formal Michelin stars. I'd love to hear from you at 866-893-KPECC. The call-in number, 866-893-5722. A chance for you to weigh in what you think about the restaurants that are featured as well as some of the ones that are not included here. 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. The Michelin Guide is back in Greater Los Angeles, first time in nearly a decade. Far more comprehensive listings, including not just the starred restaurants, fine dining establishments for which they're known around the world, but Michelin also pointing out some of the gems that we as locals might know if we're fortunate enough to read Elena Shatkin's coverage and others who cover the local restaurant scene, but to give those who are visiting Los Angeles a sense of truly ambitious restaurants. Might not be fine dining, but are certainly fine eating, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So, Elena, let's talk about some of the different restaurants that are included here. What stands out for you for maybe a real a restaurant that could that's really going to benefit from this ranking?
Well, it has, you know, there's three tiers. There's two-star Michelin restaurants, one-star Michelin restaurants, and three-star Michelin restaurants. There were no three-star restaurants in Los Angeles.
Did we have any last time? We didn't, did we?
I don't believe we did. All of the three-star restaurants this time around were in San Francisco. The guide has a very heavy Northern California and San Francisco bias. But among the two-star Michelin restaurants... I'm really excited to see N. Naka on the list, Chef Nikki Nakayama's Kaiseki, sort of amazing Japanese fine dining experience. It's over in West LA in the Palms District. And Jordan Kahn of Vespertine, the food that he makes looks possibly as, you know, amazing as it tastes. You know, the classic Urasawa, which makes some of the best sushi around. And of course, Michael Cimarusti's Providence, which is known for his amazing and sustainable seafood. And there are a few others. And then, you know, we go down to the one-star Michelin restaurants, which, and when I say go down, like, I don't mean that, you know.
I'm looking
like,
at the names of this is not what I would call going down, but I know what you mean.
Exactly. It's not exactly going down a step, but I'm excited to see some of the stuff on here. I'm really excited to see Gary Menez's restaurant, Le Comptoir. It's this tiny little counter, that's what comptoir means, in Koreatown, where he serves all these amazing different vegetable-focused dishes, and the menu changes all the time. Like, that's a restaurant that I think is small, and people who are inside the food world know about it, but I don't necessarily know that other people do. And so I'm glad to see it getting some love. you know, I'm glad to see a Taco Maria down in Orange County in Costa Mesa. Chef Carlos Salgado getting more love. He's gotten plenty of acclaim. But, you know, hey, make the trip down there if you're not, you know, near there. I'm just excited to see all of these different little things that, you know, maybe people here who are inside the food world already know about. But if you don't, if you're not, you're like, oh, hey, maybe this is worth checking out.
And some of those with the one star places that are, you know, higher profile. Orson Winston is included.
Fantastic
on the list.
Place, yeah.
Cut in Beverly Hills, the Wolfgang Puck restaurant.
So, Tuamek, Little Lefebvre's place over in Hollywood, yeah.
Maud,
Rustic Canyon, all these other places.
So, again, if you've had a chance to take a look at the list, I welcome your input on it. Are there glaring omissions you see here? 866-893-5722 or 866-893-KPCC. Yvonne and Tustin writes on the page, I just looked at the list of five for Orange County, all fairly close except for one. Being someone who lives in Orange County, I'm sure there are more than five that should be on the list. Why are we always treated like the redheaded stepchild of L.A.? And then she goes on to make some disparaging comments about Los Angeles, including limited parking. Yvonne, I appreciate it. Do you think Orange County got short shrift here?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That is a very fair point. There were something like, what, maybe half a dozen restaurants or so featured in there over that huge entire swath. I don't myself cover a lot of Orange County, so I couldn't tell you specific restaurants
where
that like should be on there.
Yeah.
But I mean, come on. There's got to be more. And I think, yeah, they were just treated as like, oh, you know, LA was kind of treated as San Francisco's ugly, you know, unloved stepsister, you know. So if we're the less loved sibling, then, you know, I feel like Michelin treats Orange County like the really, really unloved sibling.
What is it you think about San Francisco that has gotten so many more restaurants on the list? Is it a certain presentation? Is it the names of the chef? Is it that diners are more demanding there? What do you think's behind this?
Larry, I wouldn't say it's a certain presentation. I would say it's a certain pretentiousness. And I say that as somebody who grew up in Northern California. I grew up in San Jose. I spent a fair bit of time in San Francisco. And to be fair, San Francisco does have a legit, really great food scene. But it's also a much smaller city with a much smaller physical footprint.
And easier to cover restaurants.
Exactly.
There.
It's actually easier to access the city as, you know, an outsider or even if you live there. Like, L.A. is just so vast and there are so many pockets. There are pockets within pockets within pockets in this city that it's really hard for, you know, even people who have lived here for a long time to get to know.
Yeah, even people that this is your business, it's
yeah,
tough to
there's
cover.
There's always stuff I'm learning
yeah,
and
but
stuff
in San
I don't
Francisco,
know.
Where everything's within a few square miles, it is much more
contained. I do think
contained.
It's easier to access. It's like it's easier to be a bigger fish in that particularly small pond.
Jeffrey, writing on the page, quotes Roy Choi and says, no one says it better. Quoting Choi, and I can't verify the quote, but it sounds right. I don't really have thoughts on the Michelin Guide because that has nothing to do with the life that I live. This is attributed to Choi. All I can say to those who do care about it is just from a city pride standpoint as it pertains to Los Angeles, these people dissed you right to your face. They called you unsophisticated, left you hanging, slandered the city across the globe, and now they're going to come back. Guys are going to grovel at their ankles. That doesn't mean you have to hate Michelin or the idea of it, but you have LA pride. Think about that. So this, I think, was when Michelin announced they were coming back. And
that does sound like a very
it does.
Roy Choi
quote. And he was not alone. I mean, this was a common sentiment.
Yeah, it was my sentiment, too. Like I said, I was very skeptical. I was like, you know, are they going to do a good job here? And, you know, they actually did a reasonably good job. Like I look on their Bib Gourmand list, for example, which is a list of restaurants that are really great, but don't quite make the cut for their star rating system. And I'm excited to see Bad Mash in downtown L.A. I'm excited to see Broken Spanish, Burritos La Palma, Cassia, Chengdu Taste. I could just keep rattling names off this list here. But Jitlada, the great Thai restaurant in East Hollywood. There's so many great restaurants that it seems like they took a broader approach. And this is a good thing for LA and a good thing for those restaurants, even if it has nothing to do with, you know, a lot of chefs and a lot of restaurants, or even the way I eat. The truth is, how many, you know, how often do I go to a Michelin-starred restaurant? And I'm a food writer, so almost never.
One of the things I like here, Elena, is that they've also picked sort of heritage restaurant. You mentioned Gelada. Ones that have, had an influence on the region and have been tried and true for many years. And I think that's really important, that they didn't shy away and go only with places that have been around for just a couple of years.
Yeah, we've got, you know, all sorts of interesting things on here. We've got, you know, in addition to Gitlada, which you mentioned, we've got Meals by Gannett, the great Ethiopian restaurant. We've got Mariscos Jalisco. We've got, you know, all sorts of things. And we've got some newer ones, like we've got, you know, Rosso Blue in downtown L.A. We've got very popular restaurant Squirrel, like, you know, if you want the sort of stereotypical California avocado toast experience.
All right. So, Elena, you're going to be, I know, writing about this throughout the day, talking about it as well. So, LAist.com, and you're going to lay out all your thoughts about the Michelin
rankings. Yeah, the story is up with the full list. So, you know, let us know what you think, you know, what you think deserved to be on that list, what you think didn't, what Michelin missed, and what you want to see them cover next time around. Because, I mean, this really only scrapes the surface, especially, well, like in the San Gabriel Valley. There's maybe like only 24 restaurants, 30 or something, from the San Gabriel Valley, which doesn't even, that's not even a tiny fingernail's worth of the restaurants in that area.
All right, Elena, thanks so much. Food editor for KPCC and LAist, joining us
to talk
about the release of the Michelin Guide as they're back after nearly a decade away from Southern California. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Hope you're having a wonderful day, and as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us. We're going to get to the numbers in the latest homeless census for Southern California, but I want to get beyond just the numbers. They're really important because that's, you know, where policy is going to be driven, and some of the nitty-gritty about addressing the needs of those who are unhoused. But I also want to create a bit of a word picture from the community where you live or work. If you have seen a change, either for the good or negatively, in your community with visible homelessness, I know that's only a part of the problem, but with visible homelessness, I'd like to hear you give just a quick summary of what you're seeing in your community. If you are someone who's unhoused and you have something to add about perhaps the community of those also unhoused, people that you live with. We know that we have listeners, certainly, who are in these communities that have popped up in Southern California. We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. A chance for you to describe what you're seeing in your community anywhere in Southern California's counties. Joining me is KPCC reporter who covers housing and homelessness, Matt Tinoco. Matt, good to have you with us. We've just got the hour numbers at the top of the hour here. So what are we seeing in the trends?
The trends are basically it goes up across the board, which is not great. There was one little category, veterans homelessness, where there was a statistic decrease, although it was a literally 12-person decrease over the 1 year period, which it's a hard moment because there is more work being done than ever, but also at the same time the sort of the inflow, the people falling into homelessness, that is, it continues to accelerate and continues to be a massive an issue, and that's what everybody is sort of trying to figure out. Okay, well, how are we going to actually address this? You have to stop people becoming homeless. It's not enough just to take people off the street and put them into housing, which is happening, absolutely, and happening in greater and greater numbers each year. It's just there's also greater and greater numbers of people falling down.
And I'm sure a lot of listeners are thinking, apropos what you're saying, we have Measure H, the county measure to provide services for those who are homeless. We have HHH in the city of Los Angeles with its massive homelessness problem to provide housing for those who are in need. And I know that there are some things happening with both of those, but you're saying this just the number of people falling into homelessness just outstrips the spending.
That's basically what it is. So in the this year's, the number goes up to about 59,000 this year in Los Angeles County, which is a 12% bump from last year. In the city of LA, it was about a 16% bump over last year. But basically, it's because even though there are more people being moved into stuff, there's just that inflow. So the number, LASA, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, that's what Measure H funds. That's the big case management architecture that sort of sits at the center of the homelessness response in Los Angeles County. They estimated, they publicized it for the first time this year in their big report because it's important to understanding the problem. They estimated that there are about 52,000-53,000 people who fell into homelessness last year during the time between the two counts. So they were able to house a bunch of those people, but it's just not enough because that inflow is still there.
Matt, I don't know if you've had a chance to dig deeper into the numbers here, and if not, we'll talk to some other guests about this. But I was wondering if we're seeing any change in the composition. For example, is the percentage of those chronically homeless different in the past, or the age of those? Has there been a chance to sort of slice and dice the stats here?
There's a little bit. The biggest single jump that folks have highlighted for me so far is youth homelessness, which youth in this category is defined as under 25. So it's kind of a 16 to 25 demographic, roughly, bumped up 24% in the past year. In a year, which we're figuring out why right now exactly that happens, because the thing about homelessness is that we all see it, but every single person and it's just so unique to each of that person. Like the core issue is that people cannot afford a place to live, but the reasons why that might be true can vary, vary quite dramatically over each demographic. The other chronic homelessness, which is that sort of population that's the hardest and most expensive to sort of house and draw back off the street, it bumped up 17% in Los Angeles County. It's just very hard because once someone has been homeless for a very long time, like part of what we're doing right now or what is going on in our, homeless response is, it's harder to house people after they've been homeless for that much time. So maybe you want to target people who just became homeless because at month one, it just costs less in a literal sense to house.
It's easier. They've been housed more recently. It's easier to get them back into the routine they've been in. If someone's been living on the streets a long period of time, they've also sort of adapted to that survival mode of living on the streets.
Exactly.
Let's take a listener call. Again, I'm asking listeners to share, to really put the human face on this, what you're seeing in your community with visible homelessness. I know that's only part of this, but visible homelessness. And if you are yourself unhoused, please share with me what you see with others, friends or fellow homeless Angelenos. Share your experience. Kevin in Covina, thank you for being with us. What are you seeing in your area?
I own a liquor store on the Covina-Azusa border, and I've seen a huge uptick in homelessness, camps setting up on the sidewalk and empty parking lots, and I see a lot more mental illness and drug use. However, I don't see that in neighboring communities like Glendora or San Dimas. They just get shuffled from one end of Arrow Highway to another, and it's just a perpetual problem. That's what I have to say.
Well, and is it your sense that because Arrow Highway is largely industrial, so it's sort of, you know, that's where people congregate?
Well, no, because there's a lot of homes on the street, too, adjacent, not directly on the street, mm-hmm. You know, residential communities, and they're just, you know, 20, 30 feet, or even sometimes on the other side of the wall from somebody's backyard.
Has this been a gradual increase, you see, or has this been more of a short-term burst?
No, it's been an absolute increase. There's always been a homeless problem, but there's never been, you know, towns setting up 20, 30 people in parking lots. It's never been this bad. And it's also the mental illness and the drug use, which there's always the neighborhood homeless guy. It's not that. It's a lot more chaotic.
Has this had an effect on your business?
Oh, absolutely. The number of calls to the police department have gone up drastically. You know, it's a liquor store. It's a little bit of a dicier community, but I like to keep my storefront clean. It's hard to shuffle these people, you know, off, off the sidewalk as a public area. It's just a difficult battle, and it sucks too, because you don't want to have, these people don't have a home.
Yeah.
At the same time, trying to operate a business.
Yeah, and obviously you're sympathetic to what they're going through too. Same time you're trying to run your business. Kevin, I appreciate it. Thank you. 866-893-KPECC. 866-893-5722. Glenn in Toluca Lake. What are you seeing in your area that's half Burbank, half Los Angeles?
Yes, I'm definitely seeing an increase of just people who aren't familiar to the neighborhood, roaming the streets, setting up camps and things like that. One of the reasons I feel that it's going on so much in the city, I myself, thank God, I'm able to afford it. But over the last 10-year period of living in my apartment home in Burbank, Toluca Lake area, my rent has gone from $1,000 a month to $2,500 a month, and they raise it every year, almost $200 to $300, it seems, every time I have to do my lease renewal. And I know a lot of people just can't keep up.
Yeah. And that speaks, Glenn, to the more acute homeless population, Matt Tinoco. These people not be chronically homeless, but just have been priced out by rent. And they're scrambling, and I'm sure in many cases trying to figure out, can they stay in Southern California? Are they going to have to relocate? Where are they going to get a job? What about family connections? All these complexities of dealing with their housing.
That one of the things I hear a lot is, well, why don't people move? A huge number of people are leaving Southern California.
A lot do, yeah.
To Las Vegas, Phoenix, Texas, everywhere. When somebody doesn't move, it's often because, their rent goes up and they just don't have them. Moving is expensive. The financial resources to relocate yourself and maybe your family's here, so I'll stay with my family for a while. And then at a certain point, it sort of runs out. On that, the division between chronic homeless and those who are not chronic homelessness is basically just the amount of time somebody has been homeless. If somebody maybe lives in their car after their rent goes up and they I'm going to live in my car because I can't afford this. Over time, it just mushrooms.
But important to note, most people who become homeless do become housed. They don't become chronically homeless. The problem would be even worse if that were the case. We're talking with KPCC housing and homelessness reporter Matt Tinoco. We'll continue with Andy Bales, the CEO of the Union Rescue Mission. He's at ground zero of the crisis of homelessness in Los Angeles. The homeless census numbers are just out. We appreciate all the many ways you support us here at Air Talk. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're talking about the new homeless census for Los Angeles City and County, the county with a 12% increase to nearly 59,000 county residents who are homeless. Los Angeles City with a 16% increase, now more than 36,000 Angelenos in the city who are unhoused. We're asking you to share with us what you're seeing in your community at 866-893-KPECC, or you can share on the Air Talk page. Many people already are, and I'll share those comments momentarily. But first, the CEO, Union Rescue Mission, private Christian homeless shelter, downtown LA, Skid Row, Andy Bales. Andy, thank you for joining us again. As I said, you're at ground zero where the crisis is most acute. What are you seeing?
I've been saying it for many years on your show, Larry. We have an epidemic of epic proportions. We have a crisis. We are treating a FEMA-like, Red Cross-like disaster in a very methodical, almost lackadaisical manner. How could we expect any other results? We said there was a decrease last year when we hadn't even done anything. The money hadn't even begun to do anything. And then we go out this year on one of the coldest nights, hard to find anybody, and yet the count explodes. We need to take urgent action. The folks from New York who do it right, by the way, more people die of hypothermia in Los Angeles than New York. Nearly five times the number of people die of hypothermia in Los Angeles than do in New York City. New York City has 5% that they remain unsheltered. We have 75%. They came. The Urban Land Institute came and told LA what to do over 2 years ago. They said build 60 structures like the one Union Rescue Mission is putting up in their backyard, four in each district, 15 districts, you'll get 13,000 people off the streets by 2018. That was their instruction. What do? We start building one structure in each of our districts. And by the way, we've gotten two of those up here in 2019. I'm sorry for being upset, but, you know, when are we going to wake up and realize that an urgent crisis calls for urgent action, and we're taking a methodical, lackadaisical approach, and we will never get there at 527,000 per unit of permanent supportive housing per person. Everybody knows we will never get there. We need to be innovative, efficient, create affordable housing. We need to get people under a structure immediately. We have left too many people for far too long on our streets, and now we're past the tipping point. And if there's ever been a time we need to call for urgent action, it's now.
And Andy, I want to ask you about the composition of the homeless residents you've got on Skid Row, because correct me if I'm wrong, historically, I think a significant numbers of the people there that are unhoused have been previously in jail or in prison. Now that efforts have been made to reduce the population in prisons and in jails, I was just wondering if a lot of those folks are people who you're coming out have been incarcerated and don't have the means for housing, and that a lot of the growth you're seeing are people who've been in custody.
Well, that's possible, but what we're seeing more of is more families than ever and more women than ever, especially more senior ladies. And just to give you an idea, we hit the all-time high in November of 1,549 people under our roof, and that included 110 moms, 12 dads, and 270 kids. And I cried out that, you know, our building is full of families. What do? Our family is full of children, because at the time we were the main referral place of 211. Do you know, Larry, you know what 211 began to do because I cried out? They began to bar their operators from sending families with children to us. The county and the city directed the 211 callers not to send any more families our way, despite all the hotels being full of families, despite Union Rescue Mission and Hope Gardens being full of families. Families began to be sent nowhere. I'm telling you the truth. They began to be told to live in their cars and wait weeks to be placed. We're in a state of denial. We're not dealing with what is before us.
We're talking with the CEO of the Union Rescue Mission Downtown LA Skid Row, Andy Bales. We're talking about homelessness visible in communities throughout the greater Los Angeles area. Let's take another listener call. Dave in North Hollywood, briefly, what are you seeing in your area of the valley?
Yeah, we're starting to see some very enterprising people try and create housing where there isn't any, by towing old RVs into place in areas that the city allows parking. There'll be rows of sometimes 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them that clearly aren't, you can't even move them on their own. But we're seeing, you know, families, like he said, coming in and out and living their lives out of these sort of illegally parked RVs. And unfortunately, it attracts a lot of drug use and other things, and it's making at least our neighborhood feel unsafe for the children who want to walk to and fro and stuff like that. At the same time, we have an awful lot of empathy for them. So someone's being very enterprising and creating a place to live.
Dave, some areas have ended up posting signs with no overnight parking because of complaints from residents. Is that something that any of your neighbors, do you know, have talked about?
Oh, 100%, as a matter of fact. Now that there is so much neighborhood communication going on through these Nextdoor apps and so forth, it's a constant communication, you know, largely across the valley that we hear of. But the problem is, ultimately, we've actually spoken with the police, and while they can enforce that to some degree, it's not as easy for them. And of course, they have other things to do besides enforce constant parking violations.
Yeah. Dave, I appreciate it very much. And then, as you said, where are the people going to go? Excuse me, that are living in the RVs, who have no other place. Dave, I appreciate it. I mean, It's a crisis. There's no way around it. And the issue in your neighborhood is a very real one for families, too. 866-893-KPECC. Also with us from the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, Heidi Marston joining us, Chief Program Officer for LASA. They conducted the homeless count. Heidi, thank you for being with us. Were you shocked by the size of the increase here?
Thank you for having me. I think this increase is a shock for everybody. It's never the information that you want to see with an increase in the population. What we've really been looking at is changes that we've seen within our county relative to what other parts of California have been seeing, which is a general rise across the entire state, but certainly never the direction that we wanted to go in.
And what sector of homelessness, either based on neighborhoods or composition of those that are homeless, what stood out to you about changes?
To me, the biggest piece was inflow. And what I mean when I say inflow is the high number of people we're seeing experiencing homelessness for the first time across our entire region. These aren't all people who have been on the street for a very long time. These are people who lost their home this year. A quarter of our unsheltered population that you see on the street are, in fact, individuals and neighbors who have lost their homes this year due to economic factors. So I think approaching that stark reality has allowed us to look at things from a different perspective, to think about ways that we can help stop people from falling into homelessness in the first place to address this issue.
Well, and let's say you have some form of immediate financial assistance vouchers, something like that. Are there enough places for those who've recently become homeless for them to get emergency shelter, even if the city, financially is able to do that?
We have increased our capacity for shelter across the county. However, there's always a need for more. There's both the need for shelter and sort of that temporary residence. There's also the need for permanent housing. And we know that LA County alone needs more than 500,000 units of affordable housing just to help address this crisis.
There was a few days delay in releasing the census. What was the reason for that?
Frankly, it was logistics. There's a lot of information that we're compiling and a lot of individuals who we pull in to make sure that we're capturing our messaging and we're capturing everything we need. So it was just a matter of scheduling.
I think there was speculation that the numbers were so shocking. Maybe there was fear of putting them out at the originally intended time.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Generally, we do put these out at the end of May. And again, I think this was just a matter of getting this on the calendar. Information like this, as I said, is never good information. It doesn't sit well with anybody. But the sooner that we know it and the sooner that it's out there, the sooner we can actually get to work and start addressing it.
Heidi, thank you. Appreciate your being with us and talking about these numbers.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Heidi Marston, Chief Program Officer for the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority, known as LASA. It's the agency conducting the homeless count for Los Angeles City and County. And in case you just joined us, here's the stark bad news. Homelessness in Los Angeles County has increased 12% to nearly 59,000 residents. Los Angeles City, the increase is even greater, 16%. More than 36,000 Los Angeles City residents don't have a place to live. Matt Tinoco, KPCC Housing and Homelessness Reporter, is with us. And again, we're hearing from you as you share what you're seeing in your community. Daniel in Burbank, please stay on the line. I want to talk with you about your experience. Joseph in Van Nuys, look forward to talking with you as we come back on Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. The brand new homeless numbers from the annual census just out, less than an hour old. LA City, a 16% increase in those experiencing homelessness. 36,300 at that point in time count. And for Los Angeles County, the night of the census, a 12% increase to nearly 59,000. One somewhat positive spot, veterans homelessness has stabilized, but the crisis continuing and intensifying. Daniel in Burbank, good to have you with us. I understand you sleep in your car at least some nights?
Yes, I've been sleeping in my car for about 2 years now.
And is this largely because of rent, or are there other factors that have kept you without a place to live?
It's mainly due to rent. My problem's a little more unique. I started my company last year, and what I wanted to do was focus more on my company. But at the same time, it's like other people said, rent keep going up. You have to spend time looking for a place. I just really couldn't be bothered at the time, and just started sleeping in my car just on a whim, just to keep my business headstrong going. That turned into 2 years, but it ended up being a positive for me in that the money I saved on rent, I've fixed my car up, I've put it into my business, I've bought things I've needed to invest in. So yeah. I mean, on my end, business is great now because I'm not in this ridiculous rent race.
Daniel, from the places that you park, and I don't know if you moved to different locations or you got a spot that you've found that works for you, but are you seeing more people that are living out of their cars like you in the places you park overnight?
At first, no, but then after a while, you start noticing patterns of people, yes. You start seeing other people doing it, and yeah, they're all over the place. So places like Burbank, it's more cleaner and that type of thing. People have nicer cars to actually sleep in, but you do notice they're everywhere.
All right, Daniel, I appreciate it. Thanks for sharing your experience. Let's talk with Valicia Adams-Kellum, who's president CEO of St. Joseph's Center, which is based in Venice. Thank you, Valicia. Good to have you with us again. I assume you're not particularly surprised by what these numbers show.
No, sadly, we're not surprised.
What are you seeing in the communities where you're working? How big is the increase you're seeing?
Well, St. Joseph's Center works in the Venice area, as you mentioned. We also have offices in South Los Angeles and downtown, and we certainly see an increase in encampments. We see an increase in families who can't afford rent any longer, rents that have gone up $100 or $200 is actually enough to force a family into their cars. It's like Daniel's story. He has to make the sad choice of staying in housing or earning a living and putting some money into a business or keeping his car functional. So people are making some really tough choices lately. And we've benefited from the investment of Measure H. But if you take two people off the streets and two more fall into homelessness, a week later, you end up with this kind of result.
I was wondering, particularly for the families where you say you're seeing growth. We were talking with our reporter, Matt Tinoco, about this a little bit earlier. Do any of the service providers, to your knowledge, provide relocation support? Because if it's a family, it can be expensive to move and to identify jobs in other lower cost of living communities. Do any of the providers help people reestablish themselves elsewhere where they can get more affordable housing and perhaps get a job to pay the rent there?
Well, certainly if a family or individual identifies another area or city that would be better for them, or maybe they want to return to family, we certainly provide the resources to transport them to those communities and reestablish them in their homes. Sometimes people are returning home. And absolutely, we can provide resources to make that happen. But the majority of the people who are homeless in LA County were housed in the same area that they're homeless in. And so they want to be housed in the community where they go to church, where their kids go to school. And sadly, that's very difficult with the lack of affordable housing.
And understandable, they'd want that. It's just, you know, for a lot of Angelenos, they just simply can't afford that. And many are moving out of state to other places and starting new lives and new jobs there. Matt, you wanted to add about what sorts of services for relocation are being provided?
Oh, I just wanted to clarify that the people that you see on the street are the very tip of an iceberg of a vast just a huge amount of people who are very housing insecure in Southern California. So that's the very last step of what is a very long cascade from I am in an apartment renting stably to when someone loses that housing, it's not like they're in the tent encampment the very next day. That takes a
maybe in a motel. Living with family members, all kinds of different make do situations.
Mm-hmm. And for most people who this occurs to, it is able to resolve. But the thing is that there's just – because Los Angeles is so big, there's just a lot of people – like the number is just – reality is that for a lot of people, it just can't happen. And that's sort of where we are now. And it's how do you mitigate that, which requires bigger systemic thing. What we're doing right now is taking people from that very last spot and trying to put them back into housing. But it's not addressing the overall – systemic factors that are driving this whole thing.
Let's talk with Joseph in Van Nuys. Joseph, what are you seeing in your area?
There's a 4 mile of pristine bike trail between Sepulveda and Los Angeles Valley College, where unfortunately it's full of feces and garbage and homeless tents. This is an area which is normally frequented by very small children with their families, by the elderly that live there that use it for exercise. And frankly, everyone's afraid to walk the bike trail now. I've witnessed homeless people fighting and arguing with people that are on the bike trail basically just taking down the whole area. And I've watched 818, the local gang, now posting there and selling drugs. It's just taking that whole beautiful area down, not to mention the fact that they've set fire to a bunch of 20-year-old trees. So when you walk on the bike trail, you come to these huge sections of just burnt trees and garbage, and it's really frustrating.
Yeah, and I know, speaking of bike trail, this is an issue in Long Beach as well, where the trail goes along the L.A. River, you know, beautiful trail, and I know from people that, you know, live in Long Beach that I've talked with, many of them out of fear will not use that trail because of all the tents and homeless people that are camping along the riverbed and along that bike path. Joseph, I appreciate you sharing what you see in Van Nuys. Thank you very much. Let me go back to Valicia Adams-Kellum in Venice. What sort of progress is being made to create more housing in your area there in Venice?
Well, there's a lot of progress in terms of big picture, Measure HHH. We haven't seen the development happen fast enough, but in the next couple of years, we're going to see that change. And 2 years is too long, and so we've got to ramp up the amount of interim housing. Hopefully, Venice will get the crisis shelter, which is severely needed for the number of people who are street homeless. And we're going to have more affordable housing and landlords who are willing to take people with subsidies. So we've got some promising things on the horizon, but that is far out. In the short term, we're going to have to build some shelter, some interim spaces, so that people can get off the streets because they're dying in these encampments.
Alicia, thank you so much. We appreciate it. Joaquin in South L.A. says, I know people who sleep in their small businesses. It's code violation, but they can't afford housing on their income. Joaquin talking about people that are running small family-owned businesses. You can share your experiences, observations in your community with homelessness on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org.